So Christian Canton, Associate Director at the Barcelona Supercomputing Center, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here.
We're very excited to have you here. You have not only a super cool job at the BSC, but a very interesting, you have had a very interesting career as well in big tech companies that are also very familiar to listeners here. But so just that everybody who's listening here can have a better idea of who you are, what have you been doing at the BSC? How did you get there?
Well, it's a long story. What I've been doing at the BSC, I've been here already for 1 year. I'm the associate director, which is an exciting job. So BSC is the largest research center in Spain. We host around 1,400 people. We also host the largest computer in the country, which is called Mare Nostrum 5. And we do research on a variety of topics here, like from life sciences, earth sciences, computer sciences, engineering, social sciences. I think we touch almost every possible thing that you could do with a very large computer. Essentially, we like to call ourselves, we build digital twins of anything, okay, from a human cell to a car to a nuclear reactor to whatever you could imagine. So we build digital twins. And to the question on how we did I get here, so that's a fun one, because before that, I was at Meta for 9.5 years. It was quite a long journey for me at Meta. And like 3 years ago, I moved from Seattle back to Barcelona, and I managed to get my job. Was like I was working at Meta, but all my teams were in Seattle or New York or San Francisco. What happened is that I was living in Barcelona, but I was living in the time zone of California, which was a bit awkward because I was sleeping till late and we were starting work at 5 p.m. and it was like not compatible with my lifestyle. And also like traveling a lot back and forth from Barcelona to San Francisco. And this was okay. I mean, it was like doing my thing. But one day I went to the airport. And I was like, went to the Delta counter, is like, hi, I'm checking in to San Francisco. Like, no, sir, you're going to New York. No, I'm going to San Francisco. No, you must be wrong. Like, no, here's your ticket. And I was checking, like, oh, yes, I'm going to New York. At some point, like, I'm traveling so much that I don't even know where I'm going. I was like, okay, that was a red warning to me. Like, maybe you should change something. Then at some point I decided, like, okay, I'm going to like quit Meta, do something else, think of what I want to do, maybe something that I can contribute to Spain, to Catalonia, to Europe with the things that I learned from the US. And then someone called me like, hey, we would like to offer you the job to manage BSC. Would you like to like, wow, that is something I could do, something I can contribute to my country to like help others grow, like help science move forward. So like, sure. That sounds like a perfect next professional step for me. So that's how I find myself into this chair. And so far, so good.
I want to go back in your career, but like right back to the beginning, because before inviting you even to this interview here, I was checking online and I saw, okay, he has a page on Wikipedia. That was the first surprise. And then I said, it was not even talking about you at Meta. It was just like, Christian Canton is a famous Catalan pianist, musician, and writer. I was like, what the hell, you know? So can you tell us about like just your life, actually? Like what happened there?
Yeah, everyone must have different facets of your life. Otherwise, if you only do technical stuff, hey, I mean... I was supposed to be a musician. I always wanted to be a pianist, and I did the piano career. But at some point, my father was like, hey, no matter how good you are, I mean, it's going to be really hard to earn some good money to feed your family. So study some engineering. It's not going to be bad to you. So I did study engineering. But on the other side, I keep doing my musical activities. And at some point, my focus was like musicians in America, actually like Catalan musicians in Latin America, which happens to have a lot of musicians. And I did research on that, and I wrote a lot of books about this, which has nothing to do with what I do day to day. And it's fun because once I was in Mexico and I come across a president of Catalonia, I think, or some minister, like, hey, what are you doing here? Well, I'm presenting a book. But well, how so? You are the director of the BSC. Like, well, I'm not exactly on that role. I'm going to be like printing a book on something else. Like, wow, that's interesting. So it builds sometimes a bit of confusion. But yeah, I keep thinking that one day when I give up on my technical activities, I'm going to go back to do research on lost monasteries in the middle of nowhere, looking for old manuscripts of music long forgotten. So yeah, that's like a variety of things in life. Otherwise, things are boring. It's just like to do many things at once.
And how did you get started in the more technical aspects that led you down the path that took you to Microsoft and then to Meta and the BSC? Because, you know, it's a big jump to go from the different keyboards, right? But from the piano to more technical aspects.
Right. That's a longer story. Allow me. So the first one is that when I was in college, I didn't know what to do. So, I mean, I was doing college, I was doing telecommunication engineering, and I remember doing an internship in year 2000 in Poland. The time, like, I mean, nowadays is a wonderful, it's always a wonderful country. It was a country that was still coming out of the communist era. And I remember, like, going to a university in the middle of nowhere, and there was this old professor, Professor Smolka, who told me, I'm going to show you what is computer vision and machine learning. At the time, where, like, AI was not even a thing. It was not a sexy thing. And I remember spending the most wonderful summer of my life just learning, like, how to do things with pixels and, like, trying to do the rudiments of machine learning AI. And I at that point, I said, I want to be doing that. And I remember coming back to university, it's like, I want to do this. And people laughing at me like, come on, AI is not even a thing. It doesn't work. There was no networks. There was nothing. There was this is going to, you're wasting your time. But I really liked that. And I kept working on that. And I did my PhD. At some point, I went to a company in the UK where they were doing motion capture. You know, like the movies where they pull like a suit to the actor with some retroreflective markers and they can animate things. So there was a tiny company doing that for Lord of the Rings, Pirates of the Caribbean, all the Harry Potters. And that was something I was doing on my PhD, and I moved to the UK. Then eventually I moved into Microsoft and I was still doing like AI and whatnot. But still, I was not clear of what I wanted to do. I mean, I knew I wanted to do AI, but then something really interesting happened. It was at Microsoft Research. It was 2014, something like that. And then I remember that there was a guy, a Mexican guy, a good friend of mine, who passed, unfortunately, good guy. He told me, like, hey, we're going to be doing a hackathon. At the time, a hackathon was something magical word because nobody knew what was a hackathon. Like, we're going to California to this company called Facebook to be doing some AI for child safety and to prevent child pornography. Like, come on, I am not what I do. I don't know nothing about that. He told me, but you are the expert at Microsoft on face recognition. Maybe we can do something. Like, okay, why not? Let's a free trip to California. Let's go to California. We went to Facebook at the time. And we did a hackathon that was extremely interesting. You know, like in the movies, in the US movie, we have like this cardboard of milk with this picture that says, have you seen these children? Have you seen this child? So the US has a very large data set of all the children that has disappeared. They have not found them yet. There's like tens of thousands of children. And there was a webpage at the time, which was a webpage on selling sexual favors, okay, like an eBay for prostitution. And we had the idea of trying to see if any of the faces of those missing children were to be found in the pictures of people selling prostitution services. At the time, AI was still extremely rudimentary. You were still not, there was no fancy PyTorch or TensorFlow. Everything was written in CUDA. It was like really...
What year was this?
2014, 15, okay. 16, that bracket. And what we did, like we ran, we built that in a couple of days without sleeping. We went back to Seattle. And then a few months later, someone came to my office and said like, hey, you remember that hackathon you did? Like, yes. One young girl has been safe. Through that they found the match and police managed to go find that person. And that person was sent back to his family, her family. And I remember going back home and telling my wife, I saved the world today. I really like make something absolutely right that I put AI to save the life of someone. I cannot do anything better in my life. So the day after I went to Microsoft, I quit. And say, I don't want to, whatever I'm doing, it's petty, it's small. I want to be doing AI to do the save the world, to do the right things. I went to Facebook and I say, I passed the whatever interview was quick and said, hey, what do you want to do? I want to be managing all the worst of the worst for the company. I want to be helping. And I built the first team doing like child pornography, terrorism, drug trafficking, all the worst of the worst. I was contributing to those teams for many years. It was extremely rewarding because you could count the impact you had in lives or like, And from there, I keep growing, and then I move into responsible AI. I think like Pedro, that's where we start like interacting in my career. And then at some point, I jump into this new role, which is not so much onto what I was doing on responsible AI at Meta. But still, I think like I'm helping the world doing AI in a new capacity. But essentially, the TLDR is like keep looking for interesting problems that really gives you a meaning. And when you find like that thing, like, oh, I want to be using AI to find missing children or to prevent terrorist attacks or to prevent human trafficking, then you know that I really want to invest every second of my work into that. And that's what I was doing for many years before BSc. And it was like part of who I am is like trying to do AI for good. That's where I think at some point when one day I will quit BSc in the future, long, long distant future, I could imagine myself going back to let's do AI for saving the whales or for saving children or for saving anything that is good for the world.
I think I know a lot about Christian Cahiers at this point because we interact a lot in the past. But my question is more about like your role in the BSc and how do you think it's important to have like a national center for AI in the current days? And asking like, because in Brazil, we don't have like a very consolidated national program or things like this. I think it's still a lot like, split across different universities and programs. But how do you see this and what is the impact in the long term?
There's several angles here. So you could imagine that there's a first layer of like, you need to have enough institution infrastructure to be able to train people, to make sure that, for instance, in Brazil, you can have a generation of people, young people that can learn, because AI is not a trend, it's not a what, but it's something that is going to stay. It's another tool, like a wrench, like a screwdriver. You need to know AI. So that's something that definitely every country should have enough muscle to be training people to be professional on AI. On the next level, it's a matter of sovereignty. Okay, at some point, you need to understand that everyone is taking dependencies. Okay, everyone is taking dependencies on NVIDIA, for instance, to be buying GPUs. Many people are taking dependencies on the big American corporations, Google, Facebook, Amazon, etc., to build their AI. And it's okay to be taking some dependencies, but still, every country, in my opinion, needs to be able to understand what are the trade-offs of those dependencies, what do you lose by taking that dependency, but also understand what are the parts or unique parts that you cannot take a dependency. For instance, you want to be building a model on Brazilian Portuguese, an LLM, okay? Yeah, you will take data, you will take maybe a pre-trained model, you will push a lot of data, and you will get a model. Like, you could always say, hey, ChatGPT speaks much better Brazilian Portuguese than any model I can train. That's true. However, it's not just that the model needs to be speaking your language proficiently. It also encapsulates the culture of the country, the ways you do things. Otherwise, you might have a model that thinks in English and translates into Portuguese, which is probably not what you want. So there's a matter of building some models that even might be used by government or by central banks, or by businesses in Portugal that you want to be saying like, hey, this model is a national asset. It's not perfect. It might be better to take another model. But this model, it's built by Brazilians for Brazilians, and it's used in our companies. And we will put money just to make it better year by year. If you don't do that and you just take a dependency, what you might encounter yourself is in a very awkward situation where whoever built that model say like, hey, it has become a matter of national security. We no longer grant you access to Fable or Mythos or whatever. Oh, come on, the license was Apache 2 or the license was open, whatever. Now it's not, it's cut. What happens with the models we're using? You cannot use them anymore. Then you find yourself totally handicapped, crumpled. So I think it's important that every country, of course, you can take dependencies, you will find allies, etc. But you want to be doing something on your own. For instance, at BSc, we are training a model called Alia. Alia is a model for Spanish and Portuguese, which is expected. We train it from scratch here. Great. Okay. It's not better than any American model. I can guarantee you that. But we build it. And now, like we were discussing in a meeting just before I joined you, there's going to be like a meeting of all the presidents of Latin America and Spain and Portugal in November. We wanted to propose this model. Like, hey, let's give it to everyone in Latin America. Use it. Twickle. Train it. Post-train. So that we have a federation of countries that trains a model that is for every country in Ibero-America. That's great. Actually, that could be like initiatives like that, that you try to build things, not with a money-making perspective. There's no return on investment. There's not a company making money out of that. Everything is money from public money. Then you can have like, I don't know, that feeling of we're building something together for our citizens. There's no way of just, we're not looking just to take money from them. These are the kind of initiatives that I think countries need to think deeper, foster, sponsor, etc. Because it also allows like, hey, Pedro, Fabrizio, Marcus, let's get together and maybe like fine tune the model for this dialect of Portuguese that only spoken by 20 people. Do you think that Google is going to put money into that? No. But your government or my government is like, yeah, that's a good idea, because for those 20 people, they will have a model that's with the weird, extreme rare variety of Portuguese. This also helps us somehow to preserve our legacy, cultural legacy, into an AI form for the future. I think we're still very early. This is still like very early thoughts, but I see that big alliances of countries working on that brings sovereignty and also instruments for working together, for learning together, for creating stronger alliances. It's too early, but I think we need to be thinking on those terms.
And we're having this conversation on the heels of the return of the availability of Fable 5, right? Mythos 5 as well, but Fable 5. And it added to this conversation that had been simmering for a while about AI especially, sovereignty. But it sort of blew up when the US government pulled the rug from beneath everybody's feet, right? Have you been noticing a change in the conversation that is in addition to what the conversation had already been, you know, among people who worked in AI? But when Fable 5 went away, I've been noticing that the market in general went, oh, hold on, they might have a point about this sovereignty thing. Have you been noticing a change in conversation that goes beyond the smaller circles or the AI bubble, if you will, that had already been discussing this for a while?
I think the Fable 5 Mythos moment where like they did not allow others to use it and they like thought about, that was just the cherry on the top of very long conversations that are happening in Europe, I'm sure like in many other countries, about, hey, we need to have models that we can control, that we can warranty access, etc. And this example, like, hey, look, if you take a model from someone else and this model is very powerful, someone can just pull it back. And then like, hey, what do you imagine that you built on the top of this model and then they, for whatever reason, they can cancel it. You might find yourself into a very vulnerable position. But the other thing is that I think the Mythos was a revealing model moment, because everybody saw that that model could start finding bugs, issues, backdoors in a very quick fashion everywhere. But not only that, it could find the backdoor and it could generate the exploit for that backdoor. That usually in the cybersecurity world, you find that, okay, this is broken. But exploiting that hole is going to take me 3 months of hard work. In that between time, you can fix it. Here's like, no, hey, I found the bug, and here is the way how you can exploit to really compromise the system. That was a game changer. That was like, everyone was like shaking. At some point, I was in a meeting, the Bank of France stopped even their webpage for a day because they found like some bug into Drupal that would create issues. Like, wow, even a central bank is stopping their page because Mythos found some issues. I mean, these kind of super powerful models is where like you have this discussion, hey, should this be open to everyone? Hey, should be controlled because it could be too dangerous. We were expecting that. Actually, when I was at Meta, we had teams just seeing how new capabilities could emerge from a frontier model, when frontier models were like still like tiny frontier models. But we already were testing for, is this model able to create a nuclear bomb? Okay, test it. Is this model being able to compromise cybersecurity at a large scale? You test it. Mythos just shows like, yes, it can. It can really do really bad things very fast and at a large scale. Well, this could become like a national security asset, and then it will be treated in a very different way. So that's why, like, when you're building AI, we're not no longer talking like, hey, I'm building a model that speaks like a person and I can have conversation that can help me find some more information in a fast way. No, hey, this model could really like be taking decisions that could impact millions of people. You need to start being extremely careful with that. You need to have regulations that do not hamper progress, but also allows you to grow and keep people safe. And we are moving extremely fast into that orange zone where AI is no longer a funny gadget that speaks and helps me find fast answers. It's like, no, this can really do harm at large scale very fast. So we need to start treating that in a very different way. Nonetheless, in the other side, these models can also really accelerate a lot scientific development. That's what we can find here, for instance, BSC. Like, hey, yesterday I was reading an article like China might be having AI agents that could be doing cancer treatment very fast, from the moment you take a sample till the moment you design a drug specific for your unique tumor. Now this could take years of research. There's an agent, apparently not confirmed, that could take in a matter of days have a drug synthesized for you, which changes the paradigm immensely. So of course, these frontier models can be frightening in one way, but on the other side, it's like can unlock capabilities never seen before by humankind. So this is an extremely amazing time to be living into.
Amazing, Christian. And when we speak as the BSC, me being here at the BSC as well, I know how it is to work in a public environment. So it's very different than working in a big tech. It's like you were at Meta before. And thinking about this and about all of the investments that go to OpenAI, that go to Anthropic, to Google, to Meta. Meta created like a new Meta superintelligence team from scratch, paying $10 million, $100 million, $1 billion for the people to move there from other companies and start this team from scratch, basically. So this kind of money usually does not exist in the public system. Or they do exist, but it's much harder to get to them, right? And you, being here for 1 year, I'm sure that you've been living the good and the bad of working in the public system. Also, you had the good and the bad from the private system before. So when you compare this and seeing what we, as the biggest research center in Spain, which is in the European Union, who we have access to this to European Union money, what are the hardest parts on getting this money or convincing the people that these projects are important? And what do you expect for, I don't know, after Fable, after all of this, like seeing what the other companies are developing, even for cancer, but for LLMs and everything, for us as the BSC, but also considering other public centers, like we have like a Jansi in France, you have a Cineca in Italy, you have many, many others in Europe, the Swiss, the guys that created Apertus as well. So for us who are in the public system, is it actually possible at any point to get even close to where the private companies are, and what are the biggest challenges there?
Those are great questions. So there's many things to unfold here. So first of all, private companies, they have access to unlimited resources, billions of dollars, that could be invested on a blink of an eye into a topic. Bezos, Elon Musk, Zuckerberg, hey, let's put $1 billion to do that. Presto, done. No need to write a document. Things, it can be done in a heartbeat. However, it has a problem because they will focus on few things, the things that they feel are the right things to focus, or the things that will provide more revenue, or things that are mostly related to the company goals. They might not be interested to be training a model for Brazilian Portuguese spoken in the middle of the Amazonia. They say like, how much money am I going to get out of that? Nothing. There's going to be like whatever they are interested into, they will put money. And that might not be the right thing to do. Okay, unfortunately, we might be flushed because, hey, big results are getting by doing AI agents for this or agents for that or models. Is this necessary? Do we really need that? On the other side, you say, hey, public money. Public money is slow money, and it's less money, okay? And depending, like, it's slow money in the sense that, like, we need to compete for that. We need to explain why do you want to get that money and what are you going to be doing with this? This forces you to think deeper. Okay, because you need to convince a committee, a panel. There's maybe a lot of people applying to that. And there's one thing that when I was at Microsoft, I heard from Bill Gates many, many years ago. He was saying, like, you don't need to be at the last fashion. You need to go with the before last fashion. Because the before last fashion, you know it works. The last fashion, it might not work. Okay, so it's good to be a tiny bit slower with the time to think, is this really what we want to be? Let me give you an example. In the US or in China, I'm sure, hey, we need to be training larger models because there's a race. Everyone needs to have a trillion, a 5 trillion, 100 trillion models. Sure. Hey, in order to be training that, we need to be building a data center of 1 gigawatt, of 10 gigawatt is one plant. 10 gigawatt is 10 nuclear plants. Okay. What happens? People invest billions and billions of dollars to be building that. What if they realize that, hey, we don't need such amount of data or such amount of data centers because, hey, we're going to be building smaller models for very specific tasks. We invested a few billion dollars for an infrastructure that maybe in 5 years you don't need. So that's why it's good to go to the before last. Hey, we keep growing and slightly like let others make mistakes for you and you just like concentrate on doing the right thing. Hey, we wanted to be training the next model for Alia. It's going to be huge. do we really need to make a huge model? Well, what for? Oh, just because we want to be using this model for this application. Maybe we can train a smaller model. I don't need a much bigger machine than a tiny fraction of Mare Nostrum. Hey, I might be focusing more of my efforts into the things that really matter for us. I think it's, again, there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of velocity. I think the important thing is to distinguish between what is noise and what is signal. What is important for science, like what we do here? What is important for corporations and let them play their game? That's why they are there and we are here. Understand what really the society needs. Hey, I need AI to be sorting this out or fixing this. Hey, focus on that. And sometimes I think I would like to make an experiment. I would say, like, stop doing any research or anything. And with the technology that we have until today, see what we can do without doing anything new. I'm sure, like, there's a lot of things that we're not squeezing out because we're always trying to build the bigger thing, okay? And I realized that when in my job, you talk with governments and they explain the problems to you and people ask, like, for solutions. And some of the problems to be solved are way more simple than what people think. It's like, no, I need to be doing, like, this and this and this. Like, but this is not even AI. This is just well-planned engineering. And this could be saving millions of euros and making millions of people happy. Like, oh, but I don't need an agent for that. Like, no, you need just a database with something, something. It's much simpler than that. And I think sometimes we try to build overcomplicated solutions to problems that could be much simpler to solve. And I think it's, again, is where, like, scientists need to be honest to say, like, what do people really need? What are the problems I want to solve? What is the minimum solution to give that? And with that, you have more than enough money in Europe and more than enough computing at BSC to be solving many problems. Of course, there's going to be big problems that we need to be solving. We cannot be in every battle. You need to say, hey, if we can solve 100 things, just solve 2 of them or 3 of them extremely well, even the big ones. If you try to solve the 100 of them, you will fall into this frustration mode that, like, oh, I don't have enough funds, I don't have enough people, I don't have enough compute. Just pick a couple of battles or 3 battles. Or 5 battles, do it very well, iterate. And I think, like, the public sector tries to mimic the private sector. And come on, it's David versus Goliath, no? Again, rethink, be careful, go to the before last fashion that it works, as Bill Gates said, let all the make mistakes for you and concentrate your efforts on the things that really, really matter.
Very good answer. And going back a little bit through your time at Meta, you worked in the responsible AI team there. You were training all the Llama models, actually. People still use Llama 3.1, 3.3. People still love it nowadays for fine tunings and so. But for these models, the 2, 3, 4, what were, like, these security problems that you had to deal? Like, you mentioned that you have to make sure that it doesn't create an atomic bomb, but then you're giving it to people, of course. And it should be, like, we love it that it is open source, open weights, actually. But how do you make sure it has this, at least this level of safety to be released to the public?
Well, you try to do your very best effort. I mean, it could be a very large, very best effort on every model, the Llamas or the Geminis or any other model. Like, you need to be sure that you created comprehensive enough data sets that covers the whole spectrum of harm. In every possible way. I mean, it's really hard, but, like, that's what we did. We built data sets in every language for every harm or almost everything we could. And then when we, like, check everything, we said, okay, we can sign that up to our knowledge, we did everything possible at the time to warranty that this model is safe. We had people, like, doing the CBRNE test. CBRNE is, like, all the chemical, biological, nuclear war, whatever kind of risks. Doing deep analysis and really spend a lot of time going through every check. Can you be 100% that nothing is that everything is perfect? No. I mean, otherwise you would never release anything. Still, you release them, and many of those models, we never encounter something like, oh, yeah, we didn't have thought about that. But as models become more and more capable, these tests become more and more complicated. So it's like the cat and the mouse. So you need to keep doing that, and you cannot stop that. A responsible AI team is a team that you can never, never get rid of when you are building a model. Because if you just train a model and just release it without checking on that, you could be opening the floodgates to really bad stuff. The same we do here. We test every model we build to the best of our abilities to understand that nothing bad could come out of this. But you cannot be 100% sure. No, but you try to be 99.9999. Okay, best effort. But a very large best step.
You worked at Meta in initiatives that had to do with terrorism and other misuses, I'll call it like that. And we've had many discussions here when it comes to misinformation as to when or how an asset should be signaled as AI-generated and the systems that will try to identify them when they try to sneakily not look like they were AI-generated. And there are many propositions to solve this problem. I think Adam Mosseri from Instagram, he said that it would be better if the actual real images and videos were signaled as such. Otherwise, systems should assume that they were AI-generated. So you would fingerprint the real images and videos, which of course would be, you know, there would be an incentive to have AI-generated videos signaled as genuine. So this is sort of like a cat and mouse game as well. But how do you see how this should be dealt with?
So definitely it's cat and mouse, because whenever you build a detection, a model that will detect if an image has been tampered or altered, the moment you have that model, you can try to game it just to bypass it. Okay. So the problem, I don't think, is some years ago when the editing capabilities of AI were smaller, it was more like essentially Photoshop, you just like very manual, you need to be really good. It would make sense. It would make sense that you have like on something that, you know, blockchains or fingerprints, the sensor directly on your phone, and you can guarantee that no pixel has been touched or anything. Nowadays, it makes less and less sense, because even while not editing your picture, your camera is going to do some gamma correction. There's going to be like a lot of like subtle filtering just to make your picture look better. Is that editing? Well, it doesn't change the semantic of the image, but you are changing. It's not like the reflex camera with a film that you developed anymore. What happens is that with the explosion, I mean, at the point in time, we had like the deepfakes part where like everyone was extremely worried, because it was the first time where you could really do some extremely sophisticated and costly manipulation of the face of people that could throw you off or misinform you or something. But very rapidly, AI catch up, Gen AI, and you could generate footage that was 100% AI, looking very realistic. I remember once when the first time I was fooled, and I was like, I cannot tell this is not real. I mean, even if I've seen like thousands, and I published on this topic for years, and I've been like being the chair of like one of the most prestigious forensics on AI summit, I was like, I cannot tell. Then it's a problem. Like I need to assume that everything I'm going to be seeing is fake. Then I need to maybe invest more time into education of people. So like, assume that everything is fake. Assume that you need to develop more critical sense to say, hey, is this, if there's something that is totally impossible, or something that, hey, someone is trying to manipulate me, try to be saying, no, I understand that I need to check if this is true or not through other sources. And otherwise, you will be fooled all the time. But not only on the misinformation part, this is worrisome, because you could the elections interference, defamation, you can have a lot of like really bad things happening. But then you might fall into this world on like you are creating a dystopian fake wall that everyone is seeing into the social. Like, oh, come on, everyone is nice. Everyone is beautiful. Everyone has amazing villas. Everyone has all these things that this don't even exist. And people start to live into this infinite scrolling world of like junk videos that everyone, it happens to all of us, I'm sure, that like, well, these are compelling, the jokes are great, but nothing of this exists. So then you think like, what's going to happen with art, like music or cinema or painting, where like there was a human connection with what you were building, or you were painting, or you were sound, I mean, like playing on an instrument, is this going to change? And my answer is no. And that is, for instance, now we are on the World Cup, well, not you anymore, unfortunately. Sorry for you guys. Sorry for you. So I had to bring that. But imagine that in the future, there's a Brazilian the football players. I don't know, football players are robots. The best players ever are robots. Would you watch that? No. We like to see other humans sweating, fighting. You like to go to a concert and see that musician giving everything on the stage. We still like the authentical thing. We really go and vibrate by that. It's a part of our human nature. You cannot change that. So I think I have some hope that despite all the fake world that surrounds us on generated media, audio, and everything, we still will prefer the sweating athlete or the performer in a stage or the singer doing mistakes, but the singer. So there's still a human intrinsic thing that AI cannot replace, and I hope it will never be able to replace. And sorry for the joke on the World Cup. You played great.
We are all crying, yeah, since yesterday. But I have one question, Christian. So you interviewed a lot of people like in your whole life, and I imagine, like, given all this change in the AI space, that the profile of the people that you are looking, like the talents, are changing a lot. So we gave a lot of talks in Brazil, and I think the main question people ask us is about, like, how the role is going to change in the future. Like, there is no more junior roles in Brazil, so people are expecting, like, senior level for everything because of AI. So how do you see, like, the future of, like, the first question is the future of software engineers, and the second question, like, the future of all the other roles, like, because I imagine everyone will need to understand at least how to use these tools, because otherwise, like, they won't be able to be as productive as the companies one day to be. So
this is true, that something has changed very quickly. I don't interview people in these days very often, especially like for more technical roles. But when I was interviewing, you were just paying attention, like, can this person code? Can this person, does this person know all the data structures? All the things that we're asking, a computer science kind of standards. The question is, does it matter anymore now? Because if you can have I'm not going to call it a vibe coder, but like have a code assistant that how can you help this, then you will be looking for people that can take an abstract problem and try to explain it to a machine on how to build that. And then you might always need some software engineers to go very deep in the details just to make sure that nothing is done wrongly. A friend of mine was making a joke not long ago. I don't know if in Brazil you learned Latin in high school. Did you? No. In Europe, I think they still do that. I did a couple of years of Latin. It was part of the education. Totally useless because nobody speaks Latin except, I think, in the Vatican. But why it was useful? Because they taught you how a Romanic language is built, how we create a language and how it is evolving into Portuguese, into Spanish, into Catalan, and others. So I would say, like, in the future, in the computer science department, they're going to be teaching, there's going to be, like, one day that they're going to show you, like, in Latin, like, hey, and this is Python, or this is C++. Look how people did that. Now this is no longer, because you code already, like, by explaining the machine, that makes zero mistakes. But it's going to be like something from the past. Like the same way you don't program in assembler anymore. I was a kid. They teach you how to program in assembler. It was cumbersome, complicated. It doesn't make sense anymore because we have programming language that do a much better job at a higher level. That's going to happen. I mean, that's an evolution of computer science. It's like you need now to be able to explain these very complex problems in terms that the computer can create code for you to solve that. This is not bad because this could allow you to spend more time thinking about the problems that you want to solve. That's where you bring more your brain, your creativity to create new problems to solve. That is something that I don't see it as bad. How do we evaluate people on their capability to ask the right questions? This is something that we don't know how to do that. And right now, many companies are still like doing coding interviews, knowing that someone is going to be using a code agent in the middle. So I think it's going to take some time for the industry to adjust. On your question on, like, everyone now is asking to be seniors. Well, seniors by the old standards. Yes, you want to be able to code like a senior from 5 years ago, but now you're using the AI. I could say anyone could call themselves senior when you have the right tools. Again, I think this is an evolution of how industry are going to be putting these tools into their cycle on how to create value. Or scientists, it's exactly the same. We have the same problem into conferences and people are like, oh, you cannot write an article using an AI. Why? I have the results. I mean, writing the text is literature. I might spend more time writing the results or the conclusions, but I don't need to be writing all the fluffy stuff here because I can have someone. And there's like more purists that say like, oh, no, everything needs to be written by hand. Or we're still adjusting. We need to wait still some time for really embrace what does it mean to be a senior engineer or a new junior engineer is like the same capabilities of a senior engineer of some years ago. In the meantime, we need to, well, ask these questions and make sure that you put the right people in the right places. But I don't think there's going to be a shrinking of the computer scientists. There's going to be a new way of computer scientists. We're like, you are going to be really good at thinking on which are the questions. Hi, going, hey, go to this LLM and modify me that so that I and explain and all the nitty-gritty details on the implementation. Man, you don't need to spend time on that. Or explaining machine. I want to be doing a very complex idea and work with the machine on how to solve that. And then build the code for this. I see more value into that than just valuing the how good is an engineer if they can traverse a graph into a linear time. Sure, I mean, like, I can Google that. Me memorizing that doesn't add value nowadays. I need to know that it exists, though. But implementing it from scratch, well, I don't think it's going to be. It's going to be the skill, the main skill in the future.
And speaking about skills and looking ahead, what has been, you already spoke a little bit about your, you know, why you joined BSC and what is getting you going there. But when you look ahead, what is exciting you about what's, you know, promising, appearing maybe down the corner that, you know, you're looking at it going like, huh, this could be interesting, potentially interesting. Let's keep an eye on that. What's exciting you about what's coming down the road?
Personally, many things that in the mid-level, something that catches the eye to me is like we have three quantum computers here. Okay, attached to a supercomputer. I would love to spend time understanding how does a quantum computer work, what needs to be done, especially for AI. Okay, that's something that intellectually like keeps my people saying like, yes, quantum computers are going to take a decade to really like work at the scale. Sure, until something happens and they like AI and very quickly evolve and like then you need to be ready for this because it could change the paradigm on how we do science, for instance. This is something interesting. That at least personally resonates a lot with me. Another thing that it's also very interesting for me, it's how we apply AI to less common topics. So we have a team on social sciences here. And the other day they come to me with like, hey, we managed to be doing some AI on old manuscripts from the 17th, 16th century in Spain. And we managed to find a few pages of a novel by Cervantes, the author of the Don Quixote de la Mancha, that apparently were lost forever. Like, Jesus Christ, you found this using AI? Like, yes. Like, show that to me. This is like how to use AI into topics that are not usually benefiting from AI. This is also interesting to me. Also, like, the other thing that catches my eye is all this discussion on sovereignty. How we're going to be finding an operation point that will allow us, for instance, to be doing research but having a minimum of warranties that we can do it independently, taking the right trade-offs and dependencies from other countries. This is interesting. And in general, the problem with me at BSC is that everyone that comes to my office to explain to me, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, come on, I want to do that. Hey, that sounds interesting. Like, every time, like, I want to be doing almost everything what is done in my center. I want to be sitting down. But unfortunately, I don't have time. I need to handle, like, other level things. But I love that science is benefiting from AI in a way that never seen before in history. So it's a good time to be a scientist.
I agree completely. And now that you've been over this last year here, the BSC, having weekly meetings with Pedro Sanchez, with Emmanuel Macron, with all of the most powerful people in Europe, I guess this also involves a lot of adaptation from your side, that you were in at Meta as a manager as well, but in a private company, and now you have to deal with politicians. So what is this change that you have to do with yourself?
That's true. This is a different level of complexity for me. Because I mentioned, like, when you're in a private company, you talk with anyone up the chain, and you can explain in terms of like, hey, we're doing this, that's the revenue, that's the impact, that's very clear what we need to be doing. We have infinite resources. Here, you add the other company, like, first of all, the apparatus of the public world, which is much slower than American companies, but that's fine. I mean, like, everything evolves at a different pace. You need to align many things, many people to do something. That's good. You need to explain things in a different way, more like, hey, why this is beneficial for the country or for the world, and convince people on that. It's less term like how much money I'm going to be making for you. It's more like how this science is useful for the country, for the Europe, for the world. And then, like, but I mean, the thing that I resonated, like, that at least surprised me, politicians are very curious, like, hey, explain me, what are you doing? How does it work? And at the end, it's more trying to you adapt your language to them, explain your problems, like, hey, I have this problem, I have these five options. What I would prefer one, but you have five more. how can you help me do this? And sometimes like, hey, you can, I cannot help you. Then you need to, okay, let me rethink my strategy on how can I adapt to really keep doing this or doing this other project. But it's interesting. For me, it has been a very interesting learning experience. I have to say that I had in the past the meh opinion of politicians. Now it's like I have more respect for them. I understand like how hard is their job, because in the past you only see them in TV. When you talk to them, like, wow, you had a lot on your shoulders. And the other thing that I realized, they work hard. At least the people that know, I wake at 5 a.m. and I finish work at midnight, every day, every single day. And I was like, wow, respect for you, sir. I mean, I cannot even think of doing that. But the politicians that we deal with at BSC, I'm really happy with. I mean, people that understand science, people that understand how science can benefit the country. People that also say it's no. Like when I was like, hey, I need this money for doing this. Like, oh, this is impossible, Christian. Like, come on, no. I need this. We need to find. And then like you work with them and how we can get to a midpoint. This is always interesting because you know that they also want to help you, but we need to understand how we can help each other. So I love that. I think I'm really enjoying that part of my job. But I don't meet with Pedro Sanchez. No, I am still a very small fish in this world.
And one last question on my side is about the AI Act, the AI regulation, because Europe came before anyone else in the world trying to create legislation for that. And it's supposed to, or almost the first, I don't know if you're making a face, but yeah, we are like at least before the big players, let's say, any other big players. And right now we are at a point that is supposed to come on in August 2nd, I think, but then the people are trying to postpone it for next year, even like end of 2027. There's a lot of conversation happening in the political part as well. But how do you see this for Europe? Like, is it more useful? Is it the prejudicial in a way?
So I think it's good to have regulation. I mean, you cannot just build the most powerful technology ever seen by humankind and assume that everyone is doing the right thing. That's not true. I mean, people will abuse it. People will use it in ways that should not be, etc. So having a regulation is good. How do you build a regulation? You need to be careful, because if you build a regulation before the technology even exists, that's our case, you can be over compressive or over indexing on many things, and then the technology can develop slower than other parts of the world, which might slow down Europe, for instance. In other countries, you might have way more relaxed regulations on AI or China or other places. Things might move faster, but then you will have impact, good or probably bad impact, because the regulation is too relaxed. So finding the right spot on operation, you cannot do it in one shot. You need to iterate. I think it's good that, hey, Europe was over-conservative, built an AI Act, which is trying to put a corset around the AI that is too stringent. Okay, now I think there's an amendment, the AI Omnibus regulation, that will relax it a little bit, sure. Maybe we need to relax more in the future. Maybe we need like to keep, but I think this is an iterative process. And at some point we'll find the right trade-off between how we want to be building our AI in a responsible way that we feel proud, that we know it's going to be doing the right for the good, for the people, versus like, hey, I'm building an AI that can be exploited and can do bad things or can make rich people because it's taking advantage of others. Like think about the copyright of the data, think about privacy, think about many, many, many things. So I think that Europe will keep iterating and at some point we'll reach the right spot. And I think that's part of our job too, at least to your job, my job, to keep informing people. Like, hey, you go to Brussels, like, hey, are you sure that this is the right thing to do? Are you sure we like need to be relaxing here? Maybe not, maybe yes. But pushing for those questions help us, our politicians, understand, okay, maybe we need to be thinking about that. I think it's an evolving matter that we are going to be, maybe in 5 years, we'll say, okay, that's problem solved. But again, like as we saw with the example of Mythos, we need to have strong regulations to make sure that we can control things that could be really damaging for the world. So working on different regulations is the right thing to do. It will take time. I hope that we will land into the right spot.
Christian, thank you very much for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. If folks want to maybe continue this conversation with you, ask something, where should I go?
You can go to my LinkedIn. I'm usually trying to answer almost everyone that contacts me, or my Twitter, or any of my social. I try to be proactive into providing answers to the right questions.
Maravilha. Os links vão estar aqui na descrição, junto do link do IA Conference Brasil 2026, onde Pedro Gengo estará junto com um time cada vez maior de pessoas que vão ensinar muito para a gente sobre o mundo da inteligência artificial. E você pode ver esse lineup inteiro em iaconferencebrasil.com.br, onde também você pode garantir o seu ingresso. E se você pedir ou para o Pedro, ou para a galera que está listada também no site, um códigozinho de desconto, tem, está esperando por você. Então passa aqui na descrição ou vai no site, garante seu ingresso. Vamos falar a data, né? 24 de setembro, no Centro de Convenções Frei Caneca, em São Paulo, o maior evento de IA e tecnologia do Brasil. E a Conference Brasil 2026, você não pode perder. E eu e o Fabrício voltaremos na sexta-feira com o nosso resumão das notícias do mundo da inteligência artificial. Até lá!
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura. Mergulhe em tecnologia. E Faculdade FIAP. Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.